Good evening and welcome to West End Dumplings, the radio edition for January the 24th, 2016. I'm your host, Christian Cassidy, and on tonight's show we have three guests for you. We're packing them in because this is the penultimate episode. Next week is the final week. So tonight for you we have, if I can get my little computer thingy to work here. So tonight we're going to have Chris Young. He's the head brewer at Half Pints Brewing Company, and J.D. Ormond of Sunshine House's J.D. and the Sunshine Band. And we'll follow up with Stephen Stethers of the Aquatic Hall of Fame and Museum of Canada. But first, I'm going to play a little bit of mood music from country legend Tom T. Hall.
Some of my songs I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow. Whiskey's too rough, champagne costs too much, vodka puts my mouth in gear. This little refrain should help me explain, as a matter of fact, I like beer.
He likes beer.
My wife often frowns when we're out on the town, and I'm wearing a suit and a tie. She's sipping vermouth, and she thinks I'm uncouth. I yell as the waiter goes by. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
Whiskey's too rough, champagne costs too much. Vodka puts my mouth in gear. While this little refrain should help me explain, as a matter of fact, I like beer.
He likes beer.
Last night I dreamed that I passed from the scene, and I went to a place so sublime. All the water was clear and tasted like beer. Then they turned it all into wine. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind. Sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
Whiskey's too rough. Champagne costs too much. Vodka puts my mouth in gear. All this little refrain should help me explain, as a matter of fact, I love beer.
Yes, he likes beer.
And welcome back to West End Dumplings, the radio edition. And that was Tom T. Hall with his 1975 hit, I Like Beer. And if you like classic country, you might want to check out Those Memories, a tribute to Trio at Times Changed on February the 5th. And its musicians Kerry Latimer, Jess Reimer, and Vanessa Kuzina are paying tribute to the 1987 country classic album Trio by Dolly Parton, Linda Ronstadt, and Emmylou Harris. And to follow, it's an evening of music written and recorded by female country music legends, past and present. So that's at Times Changed on February the 5th at 7 p.m. So you're probably wondering now, why do I have a brewer on the show? And it's because I think 2016 is going to be a very big year for local beer. The Manitoba government, I guess late 2014, loosened some of the rules surrounding beer production and sales. And they recently announced financial incentives for craft brewers, and there are a number of them in the works around the province. So who better to talk beer with than somebody who works in the industry? And Chris Young is the head brewer, hopefully not too much head, for Half Pints Brewing Company here in Winnipeg. And they're the only locally owned and manufactured craft brew in town. Chris, welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
And so Half Pint, you know, it's been around since 2006-ish or so?
Yeah, 2006.
How long have you been there?
I've been there since 2006. A few months after they opened, I came along as their first employee.
Oh, very good. So now, did you have a brewing background, or did you learn on the job?
No, I certainly learned on the job. I was just someone who, like many of us, was interested in beer. Small little ad in the newspaper back then, when we put ads in newspapers for jobs. Saw that, was sort of between careers at the time. And it was just the job that was going to get me through that winter until I got back into doing something else. But it's been 9 years since then. I'm still there.
Oh, wow. So no special, you didn't have to go off to Germany and live with Bavarian monks or something to have them pass down their secrets of brewing or anything like that?
No, not yet. That's still on my bucket list of things to do. Still a lot to learn, but no, is on-the-job training. Also, taking sort of the same correspondence course that my brewmaster Dave took. So sort of did that just to gain some more book knowledge and to prove that I was interested in what we were doing. And then just sort of constant learning from many different areas. Every day pretty much we're learning something new.
Yeah, because Half Pint now has its kind of standard beers, which are, you know, things like the St. James Pale Ale and the Bulldog Amber and the Little Scrapper IPA.
And the Stir Stick Stout. Those are our four.
But you also have a lot of, you do seasonal beers as well and event-based beers. So you'll do like Oktoberfest beers, queer beer for Pride Week, and there's a Pothole Porter and things like that. So that must be kind of interesting because you're not doing the same two or three brews all the time, like you're constantly mixing up what's in production.
Certainly. It keeps things interesting for us. It keeps things interesting, I think, for our fans. It's funny to think that, you know, maybe even a generation ago, people bought one beer and stuck with that for their lives sort of thing. But now, if we go a month without having something new out, people are wondering what's wrong, what's going on, how come you haven't had the latest and greatest out?
Oh, really? Yeah.
So it keeps things interesting for us, that's for sure. And, we get to play around with a lot of stuff.
And how much lead time, like, for brewing beer? So say, you know, queer beer, it's not a seasonal beer, it's for an event. So it, you know, come hell or high water, it must be ready on a certain, because if you're a week late, you've missed the whole point of the beer. So how much lead time do you start brewing something like an event-based beer?
Yeah, for in particular the queer beer, it's about maybe about 6 weeks before. It's a lager, so those take a little longer to brew than ales.
Okay.
We should be starting 6, maybe 8 weeks in advance. Because like you said, we're not allowed to be late on that one.
Yeah.
We've got a few beers like that would need to be out right on a specific time. So I like to be early on those ones. Yeah, so ales, they take about 2 weeks to make, but if we're there for a specific event, we'd like to have a couple weeks of cushion.
Because you bottle and ship. I mean, you do everything out of the, is a Rosebery that it's on?
Yeah, certainly.
You do everything out of that plant, right?
Yeah, it comes, bags of grain come in, and then bottles of beer go out the other end, and we deliver it all around town. So, yeah, it's all done in one spot.
Now, Winnipeg has had a great brewing tradition. I mean, if you go back 100 years, there were probably, you know, more than a dozen breweries going, and then the 50s and 60s, the national movement came around, and places like the Bats and Carling and Molson started buying up all of the small brews, and then they closed their local plants. So for a while, there wasn't anything until,
right,
I guess, Fort Garry brought it back in the, late 90s. I guess they came back into production. So, but even now, there's only two of you, right? There's only two.
Yeah, that's correct. There's two breweries in town. Farmies, I guess they're a beer company. I'm hoping to have a brewery up and running soon. But yeah, so it's still just us and Fort Garry in the province. Like you said, there were many for years, and they all kind of went down to zero, and then now we're starting to build that back up again.
So having now two of you, I mean, you obviously are fierce competitors in the store, but when you're doing, I mean, do you do you know each other outside of, you know, and do you do work on projects together, anything like that?
There's one project that we did work hand in hand with Fort Garry. Yeah, we as the Half Pints team went down to Fort Garry and we brewed up a Vienna lager there. And it was, we had a contest that ended up being named the Route 90 Vienna lager, because Route 90 is basically how you get from Half Pints to Fort Garry.
Okay.
So yeah, we went down there, and it's somewhat common in the industry now, and the craft industry is a collaboration brew. So we worked on the recipe together, and then went down there. The brewers went down there on brew day, brewed everything up, and then Jan, our filter man, went down there to filter with their team, and then we sent a bunch of people down for packaging as well. Yeah, quite a team effort from both sides, and then packaged it up. Six of those beers with three of our other beers and three of their other beers in the Manitoba Social Pack, it was called.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so sales were split between the two of us. It was definitely the most collaborative we have ever been, but it was great, and it's nice to, you know, we can get some of their fans can get to taste some of our beer and vice versa, I suppose.
And that, I guess, you know, with the changes that the government's brought in, and not just changes, they become actually quite bullish about the craft beer industry. They have a website that's up for people to learn how to open a craft brewery. There's mm-hmm. financial incentives and things like that that they've brought into place. And as a result, there mm-hmm. are a few microbreweries or brew pubs that are kind of in the works now. There's, I think, Pig Beer, and that's Nicole Berry, a co-founder of Half Pints.
Yeah, I know Nicole well, a good friend of mine. So, she'll be
Barnhammer is up on Wall Street. That seem to be coming. There's a lot of activity there. I drive by it every once in a while. And there's another one called Torque. And as you said, Farmery is looking at building a brewery up in, is it Neepawa or Minnedosa?
I believe it's Neepawa.
Further things. So there are a few that are coming online, and I'm sure probably more to come down the road. I guess there's two ways to look at it if you're in the industry. It's either more competition mm-hmm. on the one hand, or are you growing a bigger pie? Are you getting
right.
more people used to not drinking, you know, the watery, mass-produced Toronto beer that's mm-hmm. trucked out here? And by having more people exposed to it, they're therefore going to try different beers that you might have and different craft brews. What's right. your feeling on how that could fall?
Yeah, the latter is certainly the goal, is that, the more of us craft brewers out there and more of us local brewers that are out there, not everyone likes what Half Pints makes, so they may stay with not drinking craft beer, but, for example, if Barnhammer opens up and they happen to make something and that introduces a whole new set of beer drinkers into craft beer, and then from there, they, you know, with a visit Half Pints, be like, oh yeah, okay, maybe I would do like this stuff, and then hopefully stick with the craft industry as opposed to going back and drinking some of their Toronto beers, as you call them. that's the model that is certainly taking over in North America. As many places have, you know, towns that are smaller than Winnipeg have four breweries, and they all seem to be thriving so far. That's certainly the model that we're hoping.
Well, certainly it seems like that kind of suspicion of buying local is disappeared over the years, where, say, back in 2007, that would have been the big thing, would be to convince people why you would want to drink beer made in St. James, right?
Right.
And you could, you know, crack open a national brand of beer.
Right.
That would have been, you know, kind of the difficulty of it. Whereas now, I think in all things, you know, buying local has kind of, you know, come a little more into vogue. And you guys, I would think, would have an advantage because you are brewing a lot of different stuff all the time. So if they don't like part of your lineup, just mm-hmm. wait 6 months and there'll be something else on the market. That
right. Yeah, we'd like to think we've got something for everybody. That's one of the reasons why we brew a lot of different beers. And even so, if there's something that a customer doesn't like for a few months that we're making, yeah, instead of going and drinking something mass-produced, they'll go over to the next craft brewery and drink their stuff and wait for our other seasonals to come out. Yeah, that's what
now,
we hope
one of
happens.
The things, one of the changes that the, because you were operating before the what did the province call it? It's kind of a craft brew strategy, I guess, came
right.
out.
Right, yeah.
But it has made some changes. Growlers, I can go in and get a explain what a growler is and how we can come get one.
Yeah, growlers have certainly helped our sales. So what it is, it's a bottle of beer. It's 1.89 liters, so it's a large okay. jug of beer. It's okay. got the finger hole. Looks like the classic jug that okay. you may see in cartoons or something. So it's a refillable bottle, and you're filling. So we're shipping out kegs of beer to different LCs and liquor stores around town and some vendors. And you basically just plug in, or you hand your growler over, they plug it into a filling machine and fills it up with like fresh draft beer, resealable cap, and away you go. The okay. price point's pretty good. And it's allowed us to sort of serve our beer in a different way to people, and also a huge advantage for us and a brewery like ourselves. We like to brew a lot of different beers. One thing, we can quickly make a beer and have it out in a few weeks, and we don't have to think about labels, boxes,
oh, sure, sure.
artwork, even though that stuff is fun to think about. But there's a cost involved in that, and there's also a waiting time to wait for stuff to get back from the printers and all those sort of things. So instead of us having to pay for a small amount of packaging, we just roll kegs out, and it's great.
Oh, okay. You were mentioning before that there are some even smaller cities that have four or five microbreweries up and
yeah.
Are there cities that you visited that you think have a really great kind of craft beer culture that you'd love to see Winnipeg eventually evolve into?
Yeah, I guess pretty much every other city in North America is almost there. But in particular, on the smaller side, Saskatoon, I believe they've got five different breweries up and running there now.
Okay.
They all seem to be getting along and sharing taps around town. Sort of my favorite beer brewcation that I've been on is Minneapolis. Great town for a few different reasons. Two of them being cycling and beer. They've got a great cycling infrastructure, okay. but there's a new brewery opening up there every 3 or 6 months, it seems, and really great beer, high-end, world-class stuff, and all within the same neighborhoods, and they all seem to know each other seem to be thriving. You'll go to some of their their ballparks, and their football stadiums are serving a lot of macro brews, but also have a few of the micro brews sneaking in there as well.
Oh, okay.
So that always seems like a real coup when you get into mass places like that. So it seems to be thriving there.
Now, something that you do at the brewery is because there's a shop in there, like you can visit. It's not a, it's not a barricaded warehouse or whatever.
No.
There's a shop you can go in, and you also give tours. When do those take place?
Yeah, we do a tour every Saturday at 1 o'clock. And since I've been there, since pretty much the get-go, there's always been someone to show up, even if in a snowstorm, there'll be a couple people that drag themselves in the door. So 1 o'clock, it's free. It takes about an hour and a half. You pretty much get to take a look at everything. There's samples. And, you'll get some history, some knowledge as to how the whole process works. And, we've been having great reviews, and we've been doing basically the same sort of tour for almost 10 years now, and people keep coming back. So,
yeah, well, that's great. And, and people, because there is that kind of, I think, curiosity about, where your food comes from
mm-hmm.
and where your drink comes from and stuff. And what I liked, I've gone a couple of times on, is that you do get to test little, like some of the, especially the seasonal things that are coming
right.
up, or things that you might be working on that aren't quite, aren't quite ready yet to hit the LCs and things like that. So, and when you taste the little side by side, you can really get a sense of what you, do I like hoppy? Do I
right.
not like hoppy? And it's kind of hard to tell. When you're drinking a full bottle, but when you get the little tester side by side, you really kind of hone in on what you're looking for as a beer fan.
Yeah, for sure. And, you get a chance to, touch grain and eat it and smell hops and that sort of stuff. So then you can associate, that flavor that I really like, that's the hop flavor. So I'll look for hoppy beers from here on out. Certainly whatever we have in-house will be sampled at the time. So it's nice. And in addition to coming down to the, for the tours in our shop, one of the things that the province has opened up is what's called the tap room. So production breweries are now we're now allowed to build a tap room adjacent to our brewery. So we're in the planning stages for ours. So basically, it'll be like a small bar in the front of our our production area. So the hours are limited. I believe they're good. We're have to be open between 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. So it's not like a late night party joint.
It's kind of like when people go on, you know, vineyard tours or whatever. At the
exactly.
end, you can get that sort of thing. I went on the Guinness tour in Dublin, and at the end you stop at a very funky, nice bar and you get a couple of pints of Guinness and some of the other, well, they have the whole troika of, you know, Kilkenny, Guinness, Smittix, and Harp. They have under the banner, so you get a couple of beers after to kind of, that'd be kind of neat. So is there any ETA for when that might come about?
I think we're hoping to have it open, you know, late spring, early summer is when we plan to have that up and running.
Okay.
So the ideal customer will come down and have a couple pints while they're there, decide what they really like, and buy some stuff from us, and maybe leave with a T-shirt, that sort of thing. And it gives us a chance again to showcase some products. We make some really small runs of things where it's not really worth it for us to bottle it because it won't get to every store. So we'll just keep some kegs of different beers there, and certainly the freshest beer we have is going to be out of there as well. And it'll give us a chance to really have a new relationship with a lot of our customers. A lot of vendors and bartenders, those are the people that are actually seeing our customers all the time, where, you know, we spend most of our time in the brewery. And besides maybe online relationships, we're a bit disconnected from our customers. So it'll also help kind of bridge that gap a bit as well.
Great. And where's the brewery located?
It's at 550 Roseberry, so 550 Roseberry, which is basically at the in the industrial zone of St. James. It's the last bus stop on the number 14 bus, if you take the
number
14.
And at the
14.
Website, there's not just your regular corporate website, but there's even a brewer's blog on there, so you can keep up with in real time with what's happening behind the scenes.
Yeah, we've got a blog up on there, but I think even sort of Twitter and Facebook have sort of taken over a bit for the most up-to-date information. Seems to be a quicker way to get info out there these days. Anything that's new that's happening in Half Pints will be either on our Facebook or Half Pints I'm not sure what our Twitter handle is. I believe it's Half Pints Beer Co.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, terrific.
Something in there, yeah.
Okay, well, great.
I'm not the Twitter guy, as you can hear.
Well, Chris Young, thank you very much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me down. It's been great.
Great. And coming up after this, J.D. Ormond of J.D. and the Sunshine Band is going to join me. But what we are going to do is play a little sampling. So this is Heard That One Before. And we'll be back on 101.5 UMFM.
Down in the evening time, when the summer moves so slow, Local heroes Navalero make a triumphant return to the stage when they play the Goodwill Social Club on Saturday, January 30th as part of the 2016 Big Fun Festival. Polished purveyors of pop, this recently reformed act hasn't missed a beat with a dynamic live show, and it's one you don't want to miss. Advance tickets are only $12, available now at Music Trader and online at Ticketfly.com. Or get yourself a full festival pass and see this show and every other act at Big Fun 2016 for one low price. Don't miss Navalero with special guests Shotgun Jimmy, Not Animals, and Ashton Walker at the Goodwill Social Club on Saturday, January 30th, as part of the 2016 Big Fun Festival. Proudly presented by Half Pints Brewing, Vantage Studios, Audio Works, and 101.5 UMFM.
It's not just rich people that own the media.
But by leaving out the most important things you need to know, they can elevate awareness to a new all-time low.
I own my media.
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 The Media Co-op is a grassroots national news network that's owned by its members.
But if it's just left out, can you say the paper lied? A lot of things that happened didn't happen after all. If there's no one in the forest who will put it in the news, I guess the tree didn't fall.
Join us today at mediacoop.ca/join.
I'm joining today. You should too.
Looking for the next great act to break out of Manitoba's vibrant and constantly evolving music scene? Then be sure to head down to the Goodwill Social Club on the first Wednesday of every month for Manitoba Music's New Music Night. Showcasing nothing but the best new talent here in the 204, New Music Night kicks off at 8 p.m., cover is only $3, and you might just find your new favorite band. Manitoba Music's New Music Night, the first Wednesday of every month at the Goodwill. Find out more information at manitobamusic.com. Proudly supported by 101.5 UMFM.
And welcome back to West End Dumplings, the radio edition. I'm Christian Cassidy, and you're listening to 101.5 UMFM. And just a reminder, if you want to find out more about tonight's show and links to some of the things we're talking about, you can check out my blog at westenddumplings.blogspot.com. And joining me now is J.D. Ormond of J.D. and the Sunshine Band. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
And so the band, people may have heard of it, and it's a project of Sunshine House's Solvent Users Recreation Program. So let's first talk a little bit about Sunshine House and what it does.
Sure. I guess Sunshine House is a harm reduction oriented drop-in center for street-involved people. So basically it offers harm reduction supplies and operates on under the tenets of harm reduction, which are very broad. But generally, it means, you know, it's sort of reducing people's risks for harm wherever they may be.
Yeah. So, and there's a lot of programming that goes. So it's not like just a mission where you show up for drop in for a cup of coffee and then head out and things like that.
Correct. So the Solvent Users Recreation Project, which actually wrapped up last year.
Okay.
It was a pilot project designed to connect some of the more marginalized people on the streets with recreational activities, or connect them to recreational activities in the hopes of, having fun, for one, and rekindling their interest and their skill sets that they may have, you know, have been deteriorating. From living on the streets and, using substances that might have that effect on them.
Yeah.
So
and really people who fall between the cracks in pretty well every other part of the healthcare system and things like that. Either people don't want to deal with them or they're on the margin. So they never.
Exactly. So they're often not, their needs are not met, and their needs are great. This was something that was, you know, intended to be recreational and fun, you know, so maybe a different approach to anything that's been tried before.
And people might remember Sunshine House too. Back in the 80s, it was Kali Shiva AIDS is what it started out as.
Yep.
And I remember that was because, you know, back during the 80s AIDS crisis, that was, you know, probably one of the preeminent organizations in the city that were working It was primarily a volunteer group, I think, but they were working kind of on the front lines during kind of the beginning years, those strange years of the AIDS crisis.
People were scrambling for supports, and you know, it was one of those ones that served a lot of the people dying, basically, dying of AIDS. And Sunshine House was born out of that. And then they moved a few times around the city and basically landed their current location on Logan and Sherbrooke about 7 years ago.
Okay.
And the Cali Shiva AIDS Society kind of fizzled out.
Okay.
Sunshine House was left kind of on its own. And, you know, looking around at the community and I shouldn't really speak on it because it's not my sort of line of expertise, but I think that maybe the issues that were present in the early 90s and the late 80s were not the same anymore. So it was about reaching a different at-risk demographic. You know.
True. And again, people that were marginalized in the 80s, so kind of dealing with the same people, just maybe different problems.
Sure.
Now, many of Sunshine House's clients, I mean, they're street involved, probably deal with a lot of homelessness issues, solvent abuse, addictions, things like that, are generally thought of as kind of notoriously difficult to schedule. Because their lives are living, you're surviving that day, right? Mm-hmm. So next Thursday at 7 o'clock doesn't mean a lot to some people in that lifestyle.
Yep.
Yet you chose something that's very schedule intensive, which is a band, because it's all about rehearsals and gigs and things like that. What made you decide to marry kind of these two opposites together to create a band?
I think that... I was kind of coordinating the Solvent Users Recreation Project. So I was connecting the sort of skilled folk with the people on the streets, and you know, and vice versa. And you know, we were we had done a lot of projects, a lot of kind of modules together. And the project, the Solvent Users Project, was sort of designed to have as many skill sets kind of thrown into the pot as possible.
Okay.
So we did a...
So it wasn't just a music
It wasn't
thing
just that, music, okay. No. It was a big array of things, a big variety, so that people who, you know, to touch as many interests as we could.
Yeah.
You know, so we did art, and we did small building repairs, and we did vehicle mechanics, we did physical fitness and boxing, self-defense, and we did, photography and you know, just... A broad array of things and through all that, you know, slowly the sort of community started to really enjoy and, you know, the place and what we were doing, and people can come as they are and in any shape that they're in. So I think that that also really like helped to sort of warm people to the place. And you know, you spend 8-9 months with anyone, and their stories are going to start coming out, and I think that was the stories and the jokes and the humor and I think that was the backbone of in a lot of ways of why and how the project worked, and I think that can't be understated. You know, I think for myself, coming from where I did, you know, in Wolseley, you know, sort of middle class, I suppose, you know, connecting with folks from across town, folks that live on Main Street or in and around there and have had a totally different life experience. I think that humor and stories and that kind of sharing is the sort of linchpin that holds it all up.
Yeah, so. and it's very, even though you're the front man, it's very collaborative.
Yep.
I mean, they play in the band. We're going to play a song now sung by another member of the band. Mm-hmm. And they play the instruments. They come up with the stories. They help write the songs.
Yep.
And that type of thing. And, you know, you are a musician in your own right.
Yep.
So what sort of buy-in have you had from the, you know, Winnipeg's music community?
I think the music community has been very supportive of, as the music community is supportive of the music that goes on here. I think people really are I think that maybe they get a real sense of a Winnipeg kind of vibe to the whole thing. Okay. I think that it's it feels like how Main Street feels, which is, a major street in our city and in the city's history, and it's got a fabled past and so I think people hear that, and I think I mean people come to our shows, and we've got to play festivals all over the place.
Interstellar Rodeo this year, exactly. Probably the biggest city festival, certainly, to come along in a long time.
Yeah, in no small part due to some nepotism on that, in that case. But that's
Winnipeg, but, too, right? Sure. Everybody knows that you're 1 or 2 degrees away from knowing everybody.
Totally.
And so it really has, if you Google JD and the Sunshine Band, I mean, you have a page on, CBC Music, mm-hmm. You have a page mm-hmm. dedicated to you, and mm-hmm. there's a lot of media mm-hmm. coverage that you've been that you've been receiving recently.
Yeah, I think this is a sort of an operation that I don't mind promoting because it does have a community sort of benefit, I would say. So I think it's more than just a few friends kind of like playing in their band, and like I do play in other bands but this one is I'm an employee of the Sunshine House, so it's in the attempts to make the Sunshine House sort of grow and be recognized, and our programs have to be worthy of that, I think just getting the word out about what we're doing is something that the story is interesting, I think. So it's kind of easy to promote, or easier to promote. For
yeah.
Sure.
Now, you have, is it one CD out so far?
Yeah.
And it's a self-titled CD, came out in 2014.
Yeah.
And you are looking at fundraising to cut a second one.
That's right.
But before we talk about that, let's play another song from it. And this is, how about the Bottle Let Me Down? Now, this isn't you fronting it. Who's the lead singer on this?
This is Adrian Spence, who I brought in as a musician to help kind of grease the wheels of the program a little bit. So he plays drums on the album, but he also sings a few tunes, and he's got a great voice. And, he's just fantastic singer as well.
Okay, great. Well, here's The Bottle Let Me Down on 101.5 UMFM.
Well, tonight, the bottle let me down. And let your memories come around. I don't take effect the way it used to, and I'm hurting in that old familiar way. 'Cause tonight the bottle let me down and let your memories come around.
time the bottle let me down was 1998-99 at the Forks on Canada Day. I was with my crew and I was having so much of a good time that I just kind of noticed I woke up the next morning all by myself at the Forks with the covers over me. So I went on to my place and gave my whole crew totally shit. And that was the time the bottle let me down. I've always had a bottle I can turn to, and lately I've been turning every day, and that wine don't take effect the way it used to, and I'm hurting in the soul.
Welcome back, and that was The Bottle Let Me Down by JD and the Sunshine Band. So that's from your first album, and you're getting ready to cut a second album, and you were doing some fundraising. What for non-music people out there, what's the cost to cut an album nowadays?
Well, it really depends on who you get and where you go and that kind of thing, but we're asking in our fundraising campaign, we're asking for $8,000, which... might seem like a ton of money to folks, but you know, that's just to get the engineers and to get it mixed, mm-hmm. and to get it manufactured, and to, you know, it's not cheap. It absolutely adds up. And
you're about a third of the way there. I checked the site before you came. I think you're about $3,000 or so towards it. So
we had a big kind of blast to start it off, and it's maybe plateaued a little bit, but that might just be what tends to happen with these things, you know.
Yeah. I think in January too, it's, you know, people are tapped out until they
totally accept that January is for any of that.
And so if people want to contribute, want to find out more about Sunshine House and the band, what are the best ways to find out?
Okay, well, on our Facebook page, that there's a link to the fundraising campaign.
Great.
So you would have to go to facebook.com/thesunshineposse.
Okay.
And it's on there. There's also Sunshine House's Facebook page, which I think is facebook.com/sunshinehousewpg.
Okay. And that's also the web address. I think it's sunshinehousewpg.org.
That's correct. Yeah.
And there's a page on the band there and links as well.
Yeah, all that stuff. That's the main... Sunshine House website, I guess. So sunshinehousewpg.org. You can find everything that you need to find on that.
Oh, yeah. Terrific.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, and best of luck for album number two. Are you playing any? Do you have any dates coming up soon that you didn't let people know about?
We're playing Festival de Voyageur on Friday the 12th of February at 8 p.m., I believe.
Okay.
So come on down. You don't want to miss that one. We're going to be in a tent. It's going to be righteous.
That's terrific. Okay, J.D. Orman, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
So from my next guest is Stephen Stethers, and he's going to be talking about the Aquatic Hall of Fame and Museum of Canada, which is reopening after a decade-long or so hiatus at the Pan Am Pool, reopening later this year. And this is a pre-recorded interview that I did with him from November 2015. So have a listen, and we will talk to you soon. This is Stephen Stuthers. He's a former competitive swimmer, though you still swim at the Masters level, right?
Yeah.
And you've been posting photos of something that has been missing for about a decade in the city, going back into place, which is the Canadian Aquatic Hall of Fame,
right?
Which is showing back up at the Pan Am Pool.
Yes, it's been a journey for this collection. So if you were visiting the Pan Am Pool up to 2006, you would have seen a collection of swimming memorabilia, Pierre Trudeau's swimming trunks, which seem relevant now with his son. So Alex Bowman, a lot of Alex Bowman, Greek mythology, just a collection of amphora and really a wide assortment of items that were donated to Vaughan, and the Aquatic Hall of Fame was actually kind of a repository archive for the Swimming Association as well.
And it is at the national level. This isn't just a provincial Hall of Fame.
No, it's a national level. It's recognized. It's the Aquatic Hall of Swimming. Well, it's not swimming because it would encompass water polo, synchronized swimming, and diving. So Vaughan Baird, the founder, was a diver.
Okay.
So there is a lot of diving information.
I see. Okay. And they also have a great collection, I seem to remember, posters. Olympic posters?
There is a lot of posters.
Yeah.
There is a lot of framed posters. So just to backtrack a bit, so about 2 weeks ago, we got the collection out of storage. It is now
actually,
in Pan Am Pool.
Let's backtrack even more, because it was, there's always been a Hall of Fame, or starting around the time the Pan Am Pool was set up.
Okay, we're going back to 1967.
Yeah, and it built up over the years. And in 2006... I guess in 99, when they did the expansion to the pool, they built that big new front lobby.
Yes.
It was moved into there. And that's when I remember it. I had met Vaughan Baird and gave me a tour of it. And I think we had an event, a work event in there and things like that. And then in 2006, what happened?
The city, under Sam Cates' administration, got a little funny about some things. And they told Vaughan he had to provide insurance on the collection, and they wanted modern, up-to-date display cases. Well, Vaughan said, and this is all true, it said, well, no, the city's covering it in insurance, and so they had a back and forth going on, and then going back to 1973, Vaughan had a letter from the mayor at the time, Stephen Juba, saying that, you know, for a dollar, the city is donating everything. The Aquatic Hall of Fame will be in Pan Am Pool. The only reason it would leave is if the building was to be demolished, which we know is not going to happen. And they would take care of everything, including the display and housing and insurance. And the collection in 2006 was valued about $5 million.
Wow.
And so the city kind of had in mind that they wanted the space for other purposes, lawn bowling, spin cycle classes, just they wanted the space to do their own, you know, parks and rec events. And so, so that came to a head and they said, no, Vaughan, you're wrong. So get your stuff out. So they gave a week to pack up this collection of $5 million and get it out. And so it wasn't packed very carefully either. Obviously, we're in a rush to get it out, move everything out. Nobody thought it'd be put away for 8 years, which is what it's been now. And so once it was out, the space was vacated, and the city started putting in their green turf for lawn bowling and all the other fun things that do. Not to disparage lawn bowling, but essentially, the space was created for the Aquatic Hall of Fame. It is called the Royal Gallery, and it was built for the 1999 Pan Am Games. It was specifically fundraised, designed for the Aquatic Hall of Fame, and, I mean, just the shape of it, everything does not say a lawn bowling facility. So, you know, for the city to try and take it over, which, well, they did. Obviously, they were in the wrong, but they kept saying, Vaughan, you're wrong, and Vaughan was a lawyer. He said, I'll take it to court. And the city said, fine, we'll petition the court to dismiss your case. And then the court heard the preliminary, and they went, actually, he's got a good case against you guys. So eventually, in 2012, I believe it was, the city said, all right, let's reach a settlement. So Aquatic Hall of Fame received $250,000.
Okay.
And another $600,000 to come, because they were wrong. So there's close to $1 million of taxpayer money and 8 years of wasted time.
Yeah.
This collection has been put away, and things have deteriorated. So there are things that are not going to be kept now because of the storage location.
Oh, really?
So we're in the process now of getting the artifacts. Well, the box is opened. We're going to have to catalog, assess each one. sort into keep, not keep, you know, deteriorated beyond repair, those types of classifications.
And I guess with a lot of paper stuff that would, and fabric, there was a lot of fabrics.
Fabric, yeah. So whether Pierre Trudeau's swim trucks made it through 8 years of storage, we don't know yet. So.
Yeah. There was something else I remember seeing. There was there's medals, various medals from people. One of them from a whole collection of medals from Rita Tustin. And that's kind of a local connection because the Tustins were a great swimming family back in the day. I'm actually related by marriage to the Tustin family. And so I've done a little bit of research on Rita was one of the cousins. I think the oldest one was, I'm trying to think of her, Vera Tustin. Mm-hmm. Was the oldest one. There was one year in 27 where Vera won the seniors. Another cousin, Hilda, won like the teens. And then like the under 12s, it was Rita took it. Like they were just this phenomenal, phenomenal swimming family. And I know all of Rita's medals are part of that collection. I remember seeing them there.
I hope we find them.
Hopefully. Well, what was it like after... You know, 8 years going through these boxes to pull them. Was every box like a treasure, or were they very well marked? Yeah. And you knew
they were pretty well marked. It was about 600 boxes. To be honest, we didn't.
Wow, where do you store 600 boxes?
They're out by Glen Lee.
Oh,
so this is basically a gentleman that built storage for cars.
Okay,
and he had a connection to Vaughan somehow. Not quite sure what the connection was, but that's where Vaughan put the items to be stored. For the time being, so they weren't climate controlled, humidity controlled. Okay. It was as the weather was, and that's what was going on in there. So there's a lot of filing, there's a lot of boxes, everything's still packed up. We got the bigger items. There's a 9-foot tall sculpture of Poseidon, which is supposed to go in the front foyer area. Lots of dolphins, swimming mermaids.
Okay.
So not necessarily a swimming item, but.
Yeah.
Mythology, Greek mythology, Poseidon Bay. Vaughan had Poseidon Bay named Panem Pool in 1967, so there's a lot of that swimming tie-ins and arts and culture that Vaughan went with the Aquatic Hall of Fame. So we have the swimming collection, we've got art, we've got culture, we have artifacts, so there's really a wide array of items that we're going to be looking at what to display again, because now we have a bit more limited space. So to tell the whole story of swimming, we'll have to make decisions on what's going to be a priority to keep and store, you know, rotate displays or have a traveling display. We're not sure how to look yet.
Now, unfortunately, Von Baird isn't around to see this day. He's the one who led he was the founder.
Yeah.
And he led the fight to the city to get it back into the Pan Am Pool. And unfortunately, a couple of years ago, I guess, 2013?
Yeah, he passed away 6 months before the decision.
Oh, that's too bad.
It's unfortunate, but he prepared well. He had brought people on board to start up a new board of directors and had a consultant's report done detailing the whole legacy and what was there and, you know, having something prepared to show the city what was the value of the collection and what would equal value be, assuming we wouldn't get the space at Pan Am Pool back. So this is what is comparable for what we're looking for.
Okay.
So there was a big document done about the whole collection and the process and what should happen to it. So that was prepared before he passed away.
Okay. And you were saying before, so it has the kind of the four big pool sports. It's the speed swimming, diving, water polo, and synchronized swimming.
Yeah.
So it has a little bit for little bit for everybody. Do they jostle within? Does the synchronized swimming community try to make sure, you know?
Well, we've got members of the board from each community. So we're looking at expanding the board of directors as well, reaching out to some people that have involved in aquatics before at different levels. So we wanted to represent a wide range of people and interests, and we need the resources that that larger group brings as well. And we want to make sure it's also not necessarily Manitoba-centric, right? It does have to be Canada-centric. Mm-hmm. So we may bring in people from other regions or provinces in for phone calls or meetings and things like that to move things forward. So we're represented across Canada.
Yeah, that'd be great. Well, do you know, I mean, I guess it's because of the Pan Am Pool that it ended up here, and Von Baird, I guess, is the reason why it ended up here in the first place. You're just so used to, you know, Halls of Fame being in Toronto and places like that.
That might be lost in the mists of time, how it ended up.
The Winnipeg has had, like, you don't maybe hear about it as much anymore, but, you know, going back when they built the Sherbrooke Pool, that was the only kind of Olympic-size indoor pool in Western Canada. So really, if things weren't going to happen in Montreal or Toronto, Winnipeg was the other play. And they were huge. I mean, they had huge swimming galas, you know, with sold out audiences and international stars that would come and swim and stuff like that. And of course, with the opening of the Pan Am Pool, which is a world caliber, world caliber facility back in the day. And then after they renovated it, so they, I guess we've been kind of blessed, I guess, with good facilities.
It still is a world-class facility. What they built in 67 is still the standard for Olympic-sized pools and competitions.
Oh, okay.
Outside of some cosmetics and other things that they've done, essentially the pool is as I remember it from swimming there in the 70s, to me it's never changed. It's been the same structure and depth and quality that it's always been. So swimmers across Canada are thrilled to swim here. There's a great legacy of that tradition of swimming, swim meets, international meets, trials here. It is a pool to swimmers want to swim at and be at for competitions.
Now, you as a swimmer, as a lifelong swimmer, what does it mean to you to have this collection back on display rather than in boxes?
Yeah, a lot of childhood memories. I mean, I spent a lot of time at the pool, so I know the displays pretty well. There's a lot of Nautica themes there, again, mythology. There were ships there, and then later in the 70s and 80s with the Olympics, there did become more aquatic themed and more things became collected as it grew and got more established. So from the early 70s to mid 80s, I was at the Pan Am Pool all the time, and you kind of saw the expansion and of the artifacts and objects that came in. So to me, it was always a great memory, and anybody you talked to that was at the pool, it was always something to look at. If you're at the pool for an event, for water polo, synchronized swimming, you're a parent, you're walking around looking at the artifacts and, you know, enjoying what's there while things are still going on the pool if you've got time to kill. So it was a nice place to be immersed in that environment, you know, to see those artifacts.
Yeah.
It was appropriate. Probably the bigger downfall was there wasn't a lot of marketing going on with it. And that's probably one of the things that we're looking at going forward, is making sure it's marketed properly, the website information, content. So we're looking at really updating a lot of things on the marketing side to move it forward.
That's always the problem for any, you know, smaller organization, you know, whether, you know, museums and things like that, is really just kind of getting the word out there and marketing it.
Yeah, so I have a personal connection to it, but I want others to have a personal connection to it as well and to come see it. And you want visitors to come see it. You want travelers to come here. You just don't want, you know, people to see it because their kids are swimming or playing water polo or diving. That's why they see it. You want it to be a destination where people go, I want to go to the pool. And I want to have some recreation, physical activity, or I want to see the collection or both. So you do.
How do you get in to see the collection? Like, you don't have to go through pool admission or anything.
We don't know right now. So.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So to go forward with the plans, we're looking at having it opened for Canada Games in 2017.
Oh, okay.
So we have a target date of about April 2017. The Canada Games itself starts July 2017.
Okay.
So we're tying in to that big event. That will be a big event in the community. We're talking about a huge, you know, national sporting event coming here to a large city for the first time. Typically, Canada Games have gone to smaller communities to build up the athletic base there. This is the first time it's been held in a large metropolitan city. So it's pretty exciting that it's going to be here. And we want to capitalize on that momentum because we're going to have people from all across Canada coming. So it'd be great to see the Quadic Hall of Fame while they're here and visiting, and get the press and the media involved and really generate that momentum.
Yeah, and that gives you time to roll it out properly as well, too, right?
So I don't know what it'll look like in, 18 months, I guess, but we'll have things out. I mean, there's display cases, there's lighting we have to look at, there's UV film for the windows,
and
there's
technology,
all kinds of things, technology.
You know, technology has changed with things like lighting and all of that sort of stuff that would have changed over the last decade.
And you mentioned the poster collection. There's just way too many posters and not enough wall space now. If we were to look at what was there and where to put it, probably makes more sense now to digitize and have them online to view as a digital JPEG or item to look at and go through a collection.
Because Olympic
that way.
Posters are fabulous, fabulous artwork and things like that. So it'd be great to be able to see them or maybe rotate ones in and out.
Yeah, so
like
we got some wall space hanging above in the Royal Gallery, and we actually have the alcoves. So as you go into each of the Pan Am Pool into the spectator viewing area, typically there's this alcove where you walk in, and we'll actually have some space there to display things as well. So there will be items just inside the pool, not spread out like it used to be on the whole outside walls, but along the inside alcoves we'll have items to show
Okay.
be on display.
So this now won't be open until April 2017.
Yeah.
You got work on it till then. But if people wanted to get involved or perhaps have stuff that they want to donate or something like that, how do they get in touch?
We do have a website up, ahfmc.ca. It's kind of a rudimentary older website. Look for our Facebook site coming up.
Oh, okay.
So I've got the just the Facebook name, Aquatic Hall of Fame and Museum of Canada, you can search for, and I've just got a few images up right now, but I'm going to build some more content behind it, and then I'll start marketing that a bit more. So we'll post our announcements. We will be looking for volunteers to help unpack the boxes, catalog items. So if anybody's even interested in museum skills,
that's right. Yeah, here you are.
Volunteer experience. I mean, this is
exactly.
Where this is ground zero. This is where you learn
building,
what to do with
building
an artifact.
Museum from scratch, basically.
Yeah, this is what you learn. So you have this item. Well, how do you classify it? Where does it go? Take proper pictures of it, record it, and then it's going to have to be curated. So a large focus of the board of directors for the Aquatic Hall of Fame will be hiring an executive director and a curator. We have to hire qualified people to come in and make these decisions on artifacts as well. Us as a board can only do so much and recommend so much, but our expertise is not in that field. So we will be looking at professional people to come in, make decisions, run it, go forward, do the marketing, fundraising. There'll be a lot of fundraising coming up as well. So you'll probably hear about the Aquatic Hall of Fame through some fundraising campaigns.